This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk, with Steve and Nathan Bove. With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve and Nathan now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve and Nathan Bove on AM 790 WPRV.
Welcome to the Money Talk Show, Wednesday afternoon history lesson, along with a market report and whatever is on your mind, of course. We'd love to hear from you and help you first and foremost. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. Check out our podcast at 790business.com. Well, Treasury yields rose today after the Federal Reserve released its minutes from the January meeting, and the market didn't like it. Rising interest rates does slow stocks down. Historically, it's very easy to prove that it does not just kill returns, historically. However, it does not help, and that's easy to prove as well. So markets don't like it. Most of the time, the Fed raises interest rates faster than they should simply because the world is impatient and they get pressured. Most super-duper economic type people, that's people above my level in economics specialties, I think would say it takes 6 to 9 months to see any evidence in the economy of an interest rate change. So if you're raising rates quicker, more quickly than that, you're being impatient, and you're probably at the end of the cycle going to have gone too far. And that's what causes, you know, more problems. So we hope that they'll be patient, Nathan.
You ever heard the expression, pushing on a string? Is one of my favorite analogies when it comes to the Fed making decisions in the economy.
That's a cool one.
You push on a string, it doesn't go forward exactly.
No, it doesn't.
The way you expect it to.
Oh, it does not. No.
So you're right. You do usually need about 6 months, or even maybe even longer,
to
maybe
see
three quarters.
See what the reaction is.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Right. And but I also sympathize with them. You know, I don't mean to come across at all like I could do this any better, because this is mind-blowing jobs I think these people have. A lot of pressure. And no one really believes that anyone knows the exact right time to do anything in our field.
Fundamentally speaking, why would interest rates rising be a headwind for equities and stocks?
Bat, any companies, small to mid-sized companies that use debt at all, now cost more money to borrow. Mm. That's why rising interest rates will usually favor the large cap companies, because they don't borrow. They have a lot of cash.
Right.
They don't have to borrow. And just like rising interest rates would be more difficult on you than me, because you're going to borrow more in the next 10 years than I am, just because of your age.
Right. I would think that more risk-averse clients might be moving from equities into maybe fixed income if the rates are a little higher. You've said before on this program,
there's a trigger point.
Right. The last 8 years, it's been people have come to us, people in our business, for rates of return, because they can't get them in the bank.
Right.
So if you're an investor out there who says, man, if I could just get 4%, 3%, I'd be pretty happy.
I think the big old word for that is disintermediation.
That's the one.
I think that's the one. I'm not a big word guy.
That is the one, yeah.
It just means the rate of return guaranteed, where I don't want to talk to Steve anymore. I've actually talked to clients like this about this. You know, you get to be 86, you've been my client for 39 years, and rates are high enough in the bank that you're happy with that. I understand that.
Sure.
I wouldn't be hurt. You know, I help you do it, kiss you on the forehead, and thank you for all the loyalty, you know. People retiring right now, traditional investments are bonds, and they're the lowest return ever. That's a unique problem to have at your retirement.
Sure is.
Didn't think you'd be facing that 20 years ago when you planned your retirement.
No.
So what does that mean? If the bond yields are the lowest ever, then you have to have stocks to get yield, which means higher portfolios with higher volatility.
Right.
More ups and downs to generate the same dividend yield.
You've had to take more risk
to get the same dividend, right?
That you would have.
As a matter of fact, it's changing now because things are rising. But about a year and a half ago was the first time I ever remember in my whole career where the traditional stock dividends were higher than the bond dividends, like the 10-year.
Right. Yeah, that is a rare.
Bonds are on the agenda for tonight. They're not all created equal.
That's right.
As you may think they are. Many people ask, either on the show here or in the office or out in public in general, you know, about bonds with rates rising, and I can't have any bonds on my account. You know, it's not even true. You can't have any bonds. I mean, if you're my age and you want to be moderate, you can't have everything in stock, so you're not being what your plan is. And I believe in sticking to that discipline always, based on your own needs, your own life, your own comfort level, you know, all that. So Rates are lower than ever there, but they're rising. On a portfolio right now of stocks and bonds that can pay a dividend of 3% might be 4.5% in 5 years.
Right, and that's a poorly allocated bond portfolio right now is in danger of being subject to interest rate risk.
Yes.
There are lots of different kinds of risks that come along with a bond portfolio or an equity portfolio, but the big one that we're looking at right now in the bond market is interest rate risk when rates are rising. So the shorter that the maturities on these bonds.
Good thing the U.S. government doesn't have a net worth report because they're the one that's going to get plowed.
Oh, yeah.
They own them all.
That's true. They have all the long-term
bonds.
They
bought them all during the debacles.
That's
right. I mean, they don't own all of them. That's an improper term. But they own so much of them that if they're holding them when rates rise, the value on paper will decline. But I don't think that matters. I never hear us talking about the net worth of the
Fed or anything like that.
Yeah, you don't hear much about that.
No.
Maybe that's why they hide them there. Because they're the wrong bonds to own, and the government owns more of them than anybody does.
Right.
And even foreign governments do, too. You know, but again, if you're investing in a pension fund that's designed to provide benefits or dividend income over the next 16 generations of people, you think differently.
Sure.
About market cycles and values of accounts and things of that nature. And if you're in a trust fund, probably, or a pension, you probably would be holding more. I would be more comfortable holding some of those long-term bonds where you and I are afraid of, or I've been trying to teach you to be afraid of, you know.
Right, right.
In that type of environment, I'd be more comfortable holding them. I'm not comfortable holding them at all in private small money accounts.
Well, think about it. If you're managing a pension or a trust fund, you don't have a client calling you, asking you about the monthly statement every month. You know?
There's never a time when one person is allowed to become emotional and blow the whole thing.
That's right, right,
in
right.
Pensions and trust funds, because it's multiple brains involved.
Right. Emotion is the foe of the individual investor. No doubt
about it. I've got clients till this day that quote me and tell me 30 years ago when they met me, one of the most valuable things they learned was the day we said on the radio that it was about as much about emotional management as it is money management.
Oh, absolutely. In many circumstances, an advisor is protecting the client from him or herself.
Yes.
Making the wrong decision at the wrong time.
That's correct. That's correct. Quick little story. I've told this a few times before. Met a woman many years ago, maybe 10 years ago. She came in. She showed me a statement, said her husband had died 2 years ago, and this was his 401k money. And I looked at it, and it was $90,000. And she said, "Is that good?" And I said, "Well, it depends on what your needs are, you know, and I don't know that yet." And I said, "Well, it's $90,000. And she grimaced and told me it was $900,000 2 years earlier. And it went from $900,000 to $90,000 because her husband had the whole thing in company stock.
Oh,
because he loved the company and knew the company. He had helped founded the company, you know, and that's how you get sucked in on that stuff. The diversification rules apply all the time. There are no exceptions to it. And that was an exception. And I didn't see her again. I was sad that she didn't come back and see me again. But I remember that story, and I thought, you know, the poor thing, she probably didn't even realize what the risk was.
No.
She was out of the loop, inherited it, he just took it over. This is why if you suddenly come into money, you've got to talk to professional people about it. Even if you don't like them or trust them,
right.
Spend a little bit of money, talk to a few. Many will talk to you for free. You don't have to do anything. Just pick their brain a little bit, you know?
Right.
If you don't know anything at all, you're so vulnerable in this, huh? I mean, think of how vulnerable someone can be
in
the financial world. If you got some money, you don't know anything.
Right.
Wow.
I had a meeting with a client, a consultation. I haven't heard back from them yet. I hope I do. They're very nice. But they said they have no tolerance for risk, is what they said to me. And they showed me a statement from an annuity they had that was in a growth fund. And I said, that doesn't jive with what I'm seeing here. So maybe either this is not appropriate for you, or maybe your perception of your risk tolerance is not quite right. Maybe you do have some tolerance. Just maybe it's not zero.
Right.
Because if you have zero tolerance for risk, then all this money should be in the bank.
Right.
You shouldn't have any of it invested.
Or the fixed annuity.
Fixed annuity account. Yeah. But they were in a situation where they were close to retirement, or they hoped to retire. And he had been laid off, so they hadn't had enough funds to save.
Right.
And they did need to take some risk with the money in order to retire in an appropriate time. So it's rare that you meet people who have zero tolerance for risk.
Or someone who has unlimited tolerance.
Yeah.
Either end of the rainbow.
Right, exactly.
Most of us are somewhere in between there, north, northwest.
Exactly. There's some happy medium in there, for sure. Yeah.
This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, a station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. We're talking a little bit about bonds tonight. Maybe throw a little bit of tax conversation in there. A story or two about history. That's our favorite topic on Wednesdays. It's a great way to, you know, because, as you mentioned, this was Nathan's idea, which is a great one, that in our business, history and studying the past is the best thing we can do to have a foundational understanding of what might be the right way to view things and respond.
And help clients deal with things.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. I think it calms people down a lot to hear about stories about things happening before. This is not the first time. This is not unprecedented, those kind of things.
Exactly right. Early in my career, I used to have copies of newspaper articles all about terrible thing, the market's crashing, the world's ending, blah, blah, blah. I would show it to people, and they would always think it's what was happening that week. And I did it on purpose. I set them up, and I'd read the article to them. They'd say, what was that, last week? I said, no, it was 17 years ago. Here's six more of them. Right. You know, you're right, it was extremely helpful.
Yeah.
To help them, it kind of grounds the thinking a bit.
Perspective.
Give you a perspective on things, perspective. Otherwise, the emotion can get in the way. I know many people. Matter of fact, most of the people that I know that have invested in the stock market long term have never lost money. They never bought something and then sold it at a loss. They may have bought it, had it down in year three, held it through 6-8 years. Right. In the end, it's worth quite a bit more than they paid for it. They have never had a loss in it at all. And you'll meet people who will tell you they lose money every time they invest on their own because they're buying at the top of markets. They wait until they feel comfortable, and they fall for all of these very understandable psychological traps there is in doing this.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. This is Nate and Steve Bovee on the Money Talk Show. History Night coming right up, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bovee, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. We had a caller off air calling regarding a total bond market index. I'm going to assume he was referring to the Vanguard product, which is a total bond market index. Has a pretty good maturities, 8 years. We don't want to see 20 years. You know, that's where the risk we think is. This wouldn't be my first choice for a bond department in your account. I would prefer short duration and floating rate together. That's just my own personality, you know. But I do think this is a pretty reasonable holding, very cost-effective, an excellent company. If you have a smaller amount of money in it, I think Nathan commented during the break, I think that's true, because you're asking one fund here to really cover the entire bond market, you know, spectrum here. So I think that's okay with smaller accounts. I don't think it's okay with larger accounts.
Right. So remember we said the longer the bond maturity, the greater the interest rate risk on the bond. And this Vanguard total bond market fund that we're looking at here, 28% of the portfolio is invested in 20 to 30 year bonds.
It's a moderate selection right now, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably fine during most interest rate cycles. Not my first choice for rising rates.
And again, it comes down to allocation. You know, how much money are we talking about? What percent of the of the account is this in?
Yeah, that. What about dividend yield? You see anything on yield right now on that fund?
I can, yeah.
Probably two. I'm gonna guess it was two and a half, something like that. Probably lower than. Floating rate and short duration together can get close to 4 right now, which is almost equivalent to the 30-year Treasury.
This one's looking at Morningstar's got it at about 2.5.
2.5, okay. 2.5%. Not good enough for Stevie. Not high enough for my liking. With the two that I like together, again, this is just my opinion, floating rate bonds and short duration bonds, you get close to a 4% dividend. And to me, that's almost equal to the 30-year Treasury, with a lot less principal risk. I think how short everything is in that portfolio. Yep. Both of them are so short.
Right.
Short Lord Abbott Short Duration Fund is one of the ones that we use. so he called back to find our caller called back and asked to define a small amount of money. That's the hardest question.
That is a great question.
Yeah, and the hardest question there is in our business, I think, right? Do you think it's a lot of money? to have in one fund? You know, what I would ask if you were sitting here.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a lot? I'd ask the person himself. Do you think it's a lot to have in one?
Right, yeah.
And if he said, well, yeah, maybe, well, then that would start the conversation in the right direction, right?
Right, yeah. Right, yeah.
Again, it depends on your age and, you know, the whole thing and how much you have in it. You know, if you're 75 years old and it's $260,000, it's all the money you got, and this is the only investment you got, it's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so, again, it depends on application always.
Yeah.
Always. But, again, sorry, this is one of those questions I really struggle with.
Yeah.
How to give you a hotter answer on that one. Maybe you could shoot us a few more facts, and maybe that would help a little bit, you know,
sure.
As far as age and total amount invested and total amount you have in this account and what your comfort level with risk is, either moderate, conservative, or aggressive.
Right.
Those kind of facts would be very, very helpful.
Right.
As a matter of fact, those are the kind of facts we would legally be required to gather to actually give advice in the office. Otherwise, we couldn't give the advice, right?
That's what the CFP is all about.
That's right. You want to spend a little time talking about that right now?
Oh, you know, yeah. I just got back from a CFP review class, which was the most intense couple of days of education I've ever experienced. So
like the Tulsa education ray shooting into your head.
Yeah, so about a year and a half ago, a little less than a year and a half ago, I started the whole process of becoming a CFP. And the first thing I had to do was take a class, and I took mine online. You can do an in-person class, but I chose to do mine online. I've got a young family, and I'm working, and it was much more appealing to me to be able to do it on my own time. So
very cool. Online education.
So that
cool.
took me about eight or nine months to complete that curriculum. And that included, reading every chapter, having a test at the end of the chapter. You can't move on to the next chapter until you pass the test, you know, from chapter one. They give you some case studies that you have to go through. And then after that, they have what's known as a review course. So you take the real course, and now I'm in the review course. And they give you a whole new set of textbooks and tests and stuff like that. So I took that. And then I signed up for this review course, a live review in person with this guy, Brett Danko, who was a very impressive individual. And it was up in Milford at the Marriott. So I had to drive up there Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, today, Wednesday. Had to be there for 8 a.m., about an hour drive.
I'm remembering Donna and I doing this
as
you're telling me the story.
And we started at 8 a.m., and we went to 7 p.m.
Really?
Monday, Tuesday. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Today was a half day.
Wow.
But we had, 15-minute break here or there, half-hour break for lunch. He fed us. Nice food. Mm. But it was intense, man, I'll tell
you. It's important for people to know what's behind the CFP. It's an important, grueling educational journey, I think, and I do think those that get through that have learned quite a bit.
Yeah. The part that I thought was really useful about the live review with this guy, Brett, was... He's like the CFP superhero. You know, he travels around the country. Yeah, you know, he knows his stuff like the back of his hand. You know,
he's got some pajamas with his logo on the front.
But he's also runs his own RIA, much like we do at our firm. Mm-hmm. And he had so many stories to tell about each topic that we covered. So it was a really helpful way to remember a lot of this information that I have now 1 month exactly. Mm-hmm. I take the test March 23rd. So I have one month here to cram and to use all the materials I have.
How long is that test going
to
be for?
It's 2 3-hour tests
separated
by like a 40-minute break.
Yeah, well, 6 hours.
In one day, yeah.
Yeah. Mine was six 1-hour tests when I did it.
Yeah, yours was multiple days, right?
1991.
You went home.
I remember going to Don's house every morning and having breakfast with his kids. Donna is laughing if she's listening. She's very grown up now. I remember, talking to Donna in the morning, and then Don and I having breakfast. His wife would make us breakfast, and he and I would go off to the class together.
Wow. Mm. I remember you.
Making that decision in 1989 that was the way to go, certified financial planner.
I have vague memories of being at home at our old house in Cumberland, and you being in a chair, a lazy boy recliner with the books, all the papers and books sitting on your lap.
Okay,
and thinking,
you remember that, huh?
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember
nice.
Being a lot of... a lot of materials, a lot of books and stuff. And wondering.
It still is. Now, a lot of it's online. I had to carry books around.
Yeah, I have books.
I needed a burrow.
Yeah, I have both. I have online component, and I have four textbooks that I'm working with right now. Yeah.
Isn't the opportunity to be educated so amazing today, though, because of the Internet?
Yeah.
Maybe not for everybody, but for the right person who can learn that way, I can learn that way without a teacher.
Yeah.
I could always learn that way.
No, you're right.
Just give me the facts.
Yeah.
And although I enjoyed many of the teachers I had, it was a very nice part of my life, my journey. But I didn't need that to learn. I could do it the other way, and it's inexpensive. and really going to opens the doors to a lot for a lot of people. I think it's a great, well, the greatest thing. You don't hear too much about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could talk about things like I'm doing, you know, from one, on one end of the spectrum, and then all the way on the other end of the spectrum, whether you want to replace your, you know, a bulb in your headlight on your car, what? You know, YouTube, blah, 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 you know, what was that thing you had me replace recently in my Jeep? That was that. The resistor fan.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what? What are you talking about? I went on YouTube, typed it
found
in.
Found it. Yep.
It's a 5-minute video, showed me how to do it. I went in and out.
Yeah, that's how I fixed my water pump and my Mercury.
$20.
My outboard engine that way.
$20.
Yeah, yeah. That's chopping jobs down too, though. Because years ago, that would have had to go to the mechanic shop. They would have figured that out, you know, that way. You know, I happen to know because our fearless leader, Rainey, is a great mechanic. So we have some knowledge in the family of these things.
Right, right. Well, it was a library.
And like me, you enjoy fixing things yourself if you can. It's not a cheap thing.
No, it's saving money.
But you're a young family man, too, and the money's important. And but, you know, every time you do something like that, you learn a little more. And I always thought, as you get a little older, that just is part of your overall confidence you have as a person if you can do lots of different stuff. What if the world went crazy and you had to do other stuff for a living? At least you have other skills.
Yeah.
So I always thought it was good when you're younger.
Right.
And then when you get a little bit older, make a few bucks, step aside, and pay the young people to do those things, you know, when you, at that stage of the game.
I'm just not replacing the door at my house.
No. We've talked about that already. No doors. You ever try to put a door in a house?
Oh,
hang a door
God,
correctly?
It's so hard.
Any of you people out there that can hang a door correctly, boy, you got some skills. Because I can do lots of stuff. And
that is
I could.
Hard.
I can't. I tried 3 times. What a disaster that was.
Yeah.
Doors.
Yeah, give me the contractor for that one.
You don't get distracted here. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790 with Nathan and Steve Bove. History class when we return.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. All bonds are not created equal. Take a look at short duration bonds, ETFs I like, and a floating rate. You get a dividend of about 4% with some very nice rising rate protection there. Those are my two favorite buddies in the bond department. In my bond department, that's who's there right now working.
Buddies.
My two buddies, short duration and floating rate. Yep.
Wednesday night, history night here on the Money Talk program, and we're going to talk a little bit tonight about how the Federal Reserve came around and central banking in the United States in general. Many people are surprised to hear that the country didn't have a central bank for many, many years. We're talking like 50, 60, 70 years.
When transportation is difficult, that's difficult.
Well, it's a very interesting story. Now that you mention it, the United States had central banking when it was first set up. So right at the 1780s, the first Bank of the United States, a very cleverly named bank, which was chartered for 20 years from 1791 to 1811. And this was under the guidance of the man on the $10 bill, Alexander Hamilton, who was the treasurer at that time. And this was what they were trying to do, or what Hamilton's goals were at the time, were to have the federal government assume a lot of the state's Revolutionary War debts and to pay off these debts and raise money for the new government and create a common currency, which was they thought, or he thought anyway, was going to be key to getting this country to compete with other countries, more developed countries, mainly Britain and France. So The bank, though, was very controversial. One of the big controversies about the thing was that foreigners owned shares in the bank. There was 10 million in stock issued. 2 million was owned by Congress. But the other 8 million was owned by American citizens and by foreign citizens. So there were foreigners who were profiting from the bank. And this drew a lot of criticism from a lot of politicians, mainly people like Thomas Jefferson and all the other people who fell into his camp, the Federalists, as they were known back then, which were Alexander Hamilton, were very pro-bank. But the currency that was issued by the First Bank of the United States represented about 20% of the paper money in the country at that time. And many people are surprised to hear that there is even paper money in the United States at that time. They think, oh, just gold and silver coins. And yes, there were gold and silver coins back then, but there was also a lot of paper money that were issued by small local banks. And they would be, you know, promises for a $1, $2, $5, $10, but they were not uniform like we experience today. Federal Reserve notes, obviously, every $10 bill looks exactly the same. $10 bills back then would be very different. They would look very different depending on what bank it came from. And it would be traded many times at a discount. And this could be because either the bank wasn't doing well or the bank was far away. So let's say I had a $10 note from the Bank of Providence, you know, and I'm down in Narragansett and I want to purchase some bushels of hay with this $10 note. And the man accepting the note says, well, I'm not going to Providence for probably another couple of months, so I can't cash this. I'll tell you what. I'll give you $8 worth of hay for that $10 note.
They'll cover the time and hassle me cashing it in.
Right. Or they were local, very close, and he said, well, I saw in the newspaper last week that this bank is in trouble, so I'll give you $8 worth of hay for that $10 note.
Because I'm taking a risk, in my opinion.
Right, right.
By accepting it.
It's a very different concept of what we're used to today, right? A $20 bill, you could take it anywhere in the country, it's worth $20 of product or service.
Right, right.
So this bank existed, like I said, for the first 20 years the country was around, and then it didn't exist for about 5 years, from 1811 to 1816. The recharter bill was defeated by one single vote in both the House and the Senate. And this was right during the time of the War of 1812. The country was at war with Britain again. A lot of turmoil in the country, and we experienced a lot of terrible inflation at that time. Treasury notes were issued to finance the war. This was the first time the Treasury ever issued notes. Many argued that it was a matter of national security after the war was over was to get a bank back in place. So they chartered another bank. Do you want to take a guess at what the next bank was called? The Second Bank of the United States.
Bank of Beauvais, I was going to say, no?
The second bank. The guy that did the...
What does Bank of America fit in all this, do you know?
They weren't around yet. But that's a fascinating story, too, Bank of America.
It was
Bank of Italy, yeah.
I told my friend John that. He didn't agree, but I told him.
They took a long, winding road to get to Bank of America. But,
okay.
What was I going to say? Oh, the guy who did the CFP review thing, he had a T-shirt that was a credit card on the front. It said Bank of Dad.
There you go.
And it said... issuer since birth, a member since birth, and expiration, never.
Never.
I thought that was pretty funny.
That's cute, huh?
Yeah.
Being a young father yourself.
Right. So
can relate.
The Second Bank of the United States was chartered in 1816 to 1836 on a 20-year charter, and the roots of the resurrection lay fundamentally in the transformation of the U.S. from an agrarian society to one that was becoming more interdependent with finance and industry. The bank was very similar to the first bank, again, 20% stockholder, Congress was, and it represented about 20% of the money supply. And it held about one-third of all the gold and silver in circulation at that time in the central bank. They had many different branches.
That's a lot.
It was a lot, yeah. One of the reasons why people like Andrew Jackson, the seventh president of the United States, hated the bank and made it a very vocal point of his campaign to end the bank and to kill the bank. I mean, these are the words he used when he ran for president. I'm going to kill that bank and bring it down.
Right.
And people loved it. They ate it up. Because at that time, the country was...
Envy of big money. It's always been there.
Well, see, the thing is, when the country first founded, only white male landowners could vote.
Right.
In the 1830s, that changed to all white men, even those who didn't own land. The reality is that the ones who didn't own land were less educated.
Right.
And we're more prone to these types of rambling and, you know, and rhetoric.
Rhetoric.
Right, yeah. Rhetoric. So Jackson won the election and famously took the bank down and vetoed its recharter, and the bank was no more. And we didn't have a central bank in the United States from a period of about, I think it was like 1837 to about 1862. And this period in our history of banking was known as a free banking era, which meant there weren't the laws on how to open a bank were up to the states. There were no federal laws at all on the books when it came to banking. So
that's a lot of responsibility.
Absolutely.
For the states.
Yeah, you better believe it.
That's those poor people running those states. They don't have that kind of background.
Better believe it.
To know how to do that.
So it was only chartered state banks that existed at that time, and they were issuing notes against specie, which are gold and silver coins. And these banks had always existed alongside the central bank, but now that the central bank wasn't around to give it that nice cushion for the stable currency, you know, inflation really went up and down a lot during this time period, especially with the Civil War right smack in the middle of this time period. But every state had different laws. Like Michigan was one of the first ones to pass automatic chartering, so long as they met certain requirements like reserve requirements or interest rates, capital requirements. And we saw a huge increase in the number of these state banks. In 1797, there were 24 state banks. And by 1837, there were 712 of them. Now, this had a lot to do with not only these laws changing, but also influx of people coming into the country and more and more wage workers starting to work. Again, we were going from an agrarian society to more of an industrial society, railroads and everything taking people from one market to the next. But some states, like Wisconsin, for example, I found this fascinating, had a law banning banks. You could not open a bank. Banks were outlawed in the state of Wisconsin at this time. Some states like Indiana, Illinois, they had single state banks. Only one bank was allowed to exist in the state. It was much like a central bank of Illinois, of Indiana. And New York State was the first one to have really free banking, which made many banks. And New York obviously was the right place for that because it was the financial hub of the country, or becoming one anyway.
Sure.
But the free banking actually, a lot of politics involved in these things, these decisions. If people want to apply to become a bank, the politicians are going to sign off on it. So on one side, if you have really stringent rules, you can play politics and say, hey, buddy, why don't you slip me, what, and I'll let you get this bank off the ground.
Right,
but
sure.
If you have free banking, anybody can come in. And that is good in a way because there's not a lot of corruption going on.
Right.
But it's bad in a way because now you got
too
many banks.
No rules.
Yeah, right. So
you got to have some rules.
It's right. It's a really, really tough
Wild
situation.
Wild west of banking.
Oh, absolutely. And the banks were short-lived. I mean, the average lifespan of a bank at that time was about 5 years. Half of them failed. And a third of them just went out of business. And like I said, the real value of these banknotes fluctuated drastically.
The bank has to loan the money out to put it at risk to back up investments that are not at risk. It's like pensions. It's a very difficult thing to do, I think. And in the middle, you got to meet the margin. The people, the bank, got to get their salaries and their health insurance and their pension plan, right?
Right.
You
got
to pay for the heat and the electric and the new rugs and all that. And,
right.
And the marketing of the company and all that. It's very hard to do.
Yep. So after the Civil War ended, the federal government said, okay, we're going to start doing something about this. These state banks are running amok of everything. So the Legal Tender Act of 1862 was passed. This is when they issued, the federal government first started issuing paper money. This is the term greenback. Mm. Everyone's heard of, right?
Yes, of course.
This term originated in the 1860s. It was a derogatory term. It was used who did not have any faith in the currency. It was only worth the green ink that it was printed on.
Oh, okay.
And that's where the name greenback came from. But the National Banking Act of 1863 was passed. It provided loans for the Civil War effort. It created a system of national banks. The officer of the comptroller of the currency. I always forget how that's pronounced.
Mm-hmm. I have trouble with that one, too.
His job was to create a uniform national currency. And this was a very difficult task to do. Counterfeiting, huge problem back then. Huge problem.
How do you even handle these things?
Yeah, it's a really hard.
It's just mind-mending, melting things.
Estimated at that time, one-third of the bills in circulation were counterfeit bills.
A third.
A third of them.
Wow.
I mean, think about how that wreaks havoc on inflation and just
evaluation. Well, at some point, someone gets it's like the musical chairs. At some point, someone gets caught holding that bill, and it's not worth anything.
Right. And it'd be so easy. Today, it's hard to do because we have technology, but back then.
Really easy to do.
Really easy to do. Right. That's one of the reasons politicians like Andrew Jackson hated paper money, was because it was easy to, you couldn't, gold coins, you could not.
You ever had the idea about changing paper money? Because most illegal money is kept in cash.
Yeah.
And if tomorrow morning the government makes a law that says paper money is now going to be red, not green, you got to turn in all your green
paper
money.
You can't accept green money. Yeah,
now when you go to turn in your green money, you're going to go, where'd you get this? This is a great idea, people, how to get crime money.
That's right.
Why aren't we doing this? Just change the color to red. If all your money's legit, your cash, guess what? You got no problem. Walk in with green, come out with red.
That's right.
No big deal, right? But if that money, you can't explain where it came from, now you got a problem, right? I think it's brilliant.
It's fascinating.
It frustrated me that it's never been done.
How about this? There was a division created in the federal government that was responsible for inspecting counterfeit money and trying to get this problem under control.
Right.
And you want to know what that department was called? The Secret Service.
Secret Service. That's right. That's what they. That was their first
task.
That
was their original task.
Not God the President.
No, it was not God the President.
Right. Great history lesson. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. Hey, little factoid here. Thank you to our caller this evening who was calling about total type index bond funds in general. We pulled up a Vanguard one because it's a name that came to mind and it was easy. And I'm a little tired tonight. If we recommend a fund, we usually try to throw out two or three or four different suggestions. You know, that was just for a scientific reference. In the last 6 months, however, the share price of that fund, that bond fund, is down 3.5%. That's a reaction to rising interest rates, where the combination of a short duration and floating rate is about flat, which is where we want it to be. If we only get the dividend of 4%, they will have done their job.
That's right.
We're not looking for weightlifting performance out of the bond funds.
No.
Just the dividend, just
the rents.
Give me the rents.
The error of growth or appreciation in price, bonds, prices, that's over.
That would probably was the best, the 10 years in history. And it should be followed by the toughest 10 years in history.
I would think so.
That's what history tells us anyway.
Right.
And these things are remarkably accurate in the end, how they kind of revert back to the mean, you know, almost the way betting works in how close point spreads are and things. I always wonder how they get that so close when yet none of us can pick a game to win. I could never do it. I tried for fun, you know, when I was younger, and you and I fool around having fun competitions with each other and stuff. But you even hear, like, the guys that played in the game that were great leaders, they can't pick over 500.
No.
You know, but yet the bookies get it within a point or two sometimes of the point spread. It's very strange. Always looks similar to me as far as it being a bit mystical.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What's that about?
Hey, the history of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, so interesting. I want to do my research on this. I learned that probably the most important person when it came to the creation of the Fed was a man from Rhode Island, a guy by the name of Nelson Aldrich. Of course, you've heard of the Aldrich Mansion.
I love that name, Aldrich.
The Aldrich Mansion on Warwick Neck.
Sounds
beautiful.
Rich.
Property owned by the Province Diocese now, I think. But he was born in Forster, Rhode Island. He was one of the descendants of Roger Williams. He worked his way up as a clerk in a grocery store. He served briefly in the Civil War for the Union. He had a very long political career. He was president of the Province City Council, the Rhode Island House of Representatives. Then he was in the U.S. House of Representatives. And then he made it to the U.S. Senate in 1881 and was there for 30 years. He was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Many of the newspapers refer to him as the general manager or the GM of the nation. He was dominant in all of the decisions involving tariffs and monetary and fiscal policy and oversaw bank regulation and monetary policy. His daughter married John Rockefeller Jr., so he was, you know, very, you know, connected in with a lot of these big giant tycoons of industry at the time. In 1939, the mansion was transferred, like I said, to the Roman Catholic diocese that he owned. But, you know, he had sons like Richard was involved in Rhode Island politics. Winthrop was another chairman of Chase National Bank. So you can see how his family was very connected to banking in general. He ran for president in his grandson, Nelson Rockefeller Jr. ran for president in the 60s. And the Rhode Island Historical Society, Benevolent Street in Providence, was his home. So a lot of connections, Rhode Island. But he commissioned this thing called the National Monetary Commission in 1908. And it provided an emergency currency and established this National Monetary Commission because we had a terrible banking panic in the country in 1907, known as the Panic of 1907. And we had a number of these scares leading up to the creation of the Fed, which really pushed public opinion in the direction of a central bank. Many of the other developed nations in the world had central banks. We were the only one that didn't have one. So it had been, you know, been stewing in a lot of people's minds and politicians' minds for a long, long time. And it came down to...
Why not us?
Right, yeah, yeah. And it has its advantages and it has its disadvantages.
Sure, sure.
One of the big advantages is that you're able to organize, obviously, trade situations.
I would think the consumer would be better protected with a central bank from being gouged or taken advantage of.
That's what everyone thought, and, yeah. But it led to, it led to an exaggeration of that feeling. The 1920s.
Overconfidence.
Exact opposite problem. And people said, we don't have anything to worry about anymore.
And emotion isn't the problem in a world of money, huh? Better believe it is. You want to handle money well over your life, young people, control your emotions about it. It's what wrecks everybody who has money trouble.
Right. Mm. So we had a number of things happen actually before the Fed that led to much more big changes in the economy. For example, in 1909, Aldrich introduced the constitutional amendment to establish an income tax. This also had the first corporate excise tax introduced at the same time. Aldrich and President Taft did not expect the income tax amendment to be ratified, but it did get ratified. Funny story, Rhode Island, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, were four of the like seven states that didn't ratify that amendment. They were very opposed. Those states were very opposed to income tax because Rhode Island and New England was a very conservative part of the country at that time.
Right.
Today it's the opposite. Funny how things progress over time.
Sure.
You
have to have some kind of tax, I would think, right, to run a society.
Well, yeah. What was happening at that time was
something. I mean, how could anybody think you can pay no tax?
Happened was the Germans scared the hell out of everybody, right? So the Germans had income taxes. They were making huge strides in like submarine technology,
right.
And were really starting to like, whoa, we gotta. The United States is like, we need to really start investing in our defense
right,
and infrastructure
up.
To keep up, and we don't have any money,
right.
You know, so we need to start taxing people to do this. So, sure. Yeah, it was inevitable. I mean, there was no way you weren't going to get around that. As
right.
soon as still other countries were doing that, you had to stay competitive. So,
not only that, to protect yourself against those type of armaments that others might have, you have to kind of keep up a bit.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
In 1910, at a place called Jekyll Island in Georgia, a very famous place, Aldrich met with a lot of bank executives, J.P. Morgan, John Rockefeller was there, and many others.
Big shots.
It was a big, yeah, this is actually where these guys vacationed, Jekyll Island. Hmm. But they had this secret meeting. It was not public at all. And they were there for 10 days, and Aldrich and executives directed the proceedings. They wrote the primary features of what would be called the Aldrich Plan. And one of the guys, I thought this was a really great, interesting quote. His name was Frank Vanderlip. He was the president of the National City Bank of New York at the time. He was in these secret meetings at Jekyll Island. And he later, in his biography, spoke about the meetings. And he said, quote, "Despite my views about the value of society of greater publicity for the affairs of corporations, there was on an occasion near close to 1910 when I was as secretive, indeed as furtive as any conspirator. None of us who participated felt that we were conspirators. On the contrary, we felt we were engaged in patriotic work. We were trying to plan a mechanism that would correct the weakness of our banking system as revealed under the strains and pressures of the banking panic of 1907. I do not feel it is an exaggeration to speak out of secrecy expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became known as the Federal Reserve. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen, or else all our time and effort would have been wasted. If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had gotten together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatsoever of passing Congress. Yet who was there in Congress who might have drafted a sound piece of legislation dealing with the purely banking problem in which we were concerned?" End quote. So what his point was that all these people in the country would have flipped out if they had known.
Right.
It was a big conspiracy. All these bankers are going to get us.
Oh, of course.
You're trying to build a central bank. It's a bank, man.
Who do you think's going to know?
Who do you think's going to know how to build a bank? Bankers.
Right. But you don't understand the natural suspicion that goes along with it as well.
That's right.
Difficult. Thank you. Great lesson, Professor Bove.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow night for Don Sowa right here on the Money Talk Show, your station for talk and business, AM 790. Of all of the people that I used to know, most never adjusted to the great big world. I see a blur.